This is the Kids Health Network, the health and psychology podcast for parents and carers of children.
The Kids Health Network is brought to you by GP and my daddy, Dr. Andrew Leach. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Hello, Kids Health Network family. I've had a nice long break and it is now good to be back recording some podcast episodes for you all. And we've definitely got the ball rolling and we've got some really great episodes coming up in the next few weeks. Thanks for all your support through 2019. And this year we plan to find some more pediatric health professionals to interview on a really good wide range of topics and interesting topics. I hope to interview other GPs as well with an interest in pediatric health. So we'll also try and get the social media pages up and running again and put some useful resources on there for you. Thanks for tuning in, and hopefully we can keep providing you with some good information to help support your families. It can be difficult to know if our children are hearing us or if they're just not listening. Hearing's an essential ingredient in a child's development. Good hearing allows a child to interact with their world. Given hearing loss can be very subtle and children can't always communicate that they can't hear, we do need to sometimes intervene, and audiology is a first step in this process. So I'm here with Naomi, and she's a pediatric audiologist at Telethon Speech and Hearing in Perth. Telethon offers testing for all ages of children from newborn through to teenagers, and they also help parents with managing devices such as hearing aids and cochlear implants. Naomi's very experienced and she spent some time as well in the Northern Territory. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Naomi?
Okay, so I started out in audiology in regional Queensland, so I had the wonderful opportunity to be trained in pediatrics very early in my career, which meant that I got to see a lot of our beautiful country, covering from Bundaberg right up to the Northern Territory, seeing children with hearing loss. So I predominantly focused on hearing aids in my early years. When we moved to the Northern Territory a few years ago, I was privileged enough to be part of the cochlear implant program run through Sydney, where I was evaluating people from birth right through to their 90s, if they were well enough for cochlear implants, and part of that whole process. So evaluating them, counselling, switching them on and helping them hear again.
You would have gained a lot of skills doing all that.
Absolutely.
So I guess starting from the top, what are some of the signs of hearing loss in a child? Because it can be really tricky, and we sometimes see babies and parents are concerned that the baby can't hear them, through to the older kids where they can actually, you know, not engage at school and all those sorts of subtle signs. But is there anything specific that you would see in your practice?
The most common thing we see is a delay or in speech development. So in those early years, we expect children to be babbling and trying to engage in conversation, even if it doesn't mean anything. If they're not babbling and starting to produce single words by the age of one, then that's a sign that perhaps something might need to be looked into hearing-wise.
Yep. So is one an absolute cutoff? Because I'll see maybe 14-month, 15-month-olds, and we're still not quite clearly talking, and try to observe them a little bit and watch them over a bit of time. But is there a cutoff where you'd say, oh, it's getting actually to a point where we should be looking into their hearing?
That's a fabulous question. As you know, with children, there's a range of what is normal. One of the other things that is a sign is not being able to follow instructions, particularly if it's something that they're motivated in. So if you say, do you like to watch the Wiggles, and they don't respond to that, that's another good one. So one is a general rule, but you know, there is a continuum of what is normal, so it's a good idea to get it checked earlier rather than later, because the relevant people will be able to help you with that.
Yeah. And is it still true that sort of thinking that boys often develop that speech a little bit later than girls?
That's a trend that we
noticed. And it's genetics as well. Some families have later speech development as a whole. Is that sort of still true?
That's what we were taught.
Absolutely, yeah. So from a personal experience, I have a girl and a boy. My girl was talking very early and eloquently, and my son definitely took his time. In saying that, though, he had middle ear problems that fortunately we were able to get on top of fairly quickly, being an audiologist myself. Although having had that experience opened my eyes to how easy it can be to not notice if there is a problem. So it was actually my sister, who's a speech pathologist, said, you should probably get his ears checked. And I went, because I didn't actually have concerns about his hearing, but he did end up having glue ear. So he had what we call the unusual situation of excellent sensorineural or permanent levels. But with glue ear, he was still what we call normal, but not hearing as well as he had the potential to. Mm. So when I got that rectified, we noticed a massive improvement.
Yeah, when I talk about effusions or fluid or glue ear with parents, they often look very puzzled about what that means. They expect fluid to be coming out of the ear, or they talk about, you know, whether swimming's caused it. So I wanted to talk a bit more about some of the causes of hearing loss and maybe start with that. So what is an effusion behind the eardrum?
So an effusion behind the eardrum is a pure physical buildup of fluid. So in a normal working ear, we have the tube at the back of your throat, which everyone is aware of. It's the Eustachian tube. They may not know its name, but its job is to ventilate the middle ear. So it's the one we notice when we go up in a hill in a car or in a plane, you hear a pop. That's your Eustachian tube opening and closing. So in children, it's very flat and tends not to function as well. So it's quite common for just a physical buildup of fluid to happen behind the eardrum that you can't see from the outside, but it stops the sound from getting through quite as well as it can.
Is there an age that that can peak or be more common, or is it all ages?
It's most common in our under threes,
yep.
But it definitely can persist into older children if it's not cleared up when you're younger. It tends to commonly occur after an upper respiratory infection because children are not usually that good at blowing their noses, which is one of the things that forces open the Eustachian tube. That's not the only cause, but it's certainly the sooner that children can learn to blow their nose, you know, the quicker they can develop that drainage system, you might say.
And with the anatomy as well, we were taught that the tube itself is more horizontal in the younger kids, therefore doesn't have gravity to help drain the fluid. And then as we get bigger, the tube gets bigger and it starts to point downwards, so draining more of that fluid. So is that what you would think is accurate?
Yeah.
That's good. They taught us the right stuff.
They did.
it can be tricky though to picture that tube because you can't see it. It's behind the eardrum. And so for parents to understand, it can take a little while just to grapple with that and often show them a cross-section of what the ear looks like and help them to picture that a bit better. And you mentioned that colds can cause this.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be temporary hearing loss after a cold?
Yes. So if you notice a temporary hearing loss that doesn't clear up after a cold, that's a sign to come and see your GP.
Yep.
They can have a look. Generally, the eardrum takes on a dull appearance when there's fluid behind. And if the GP's not sure, they can refer on to audiology where we can have a look with our middle ear pressure machine called a tympanogram.
Yep.
And we can have a look at how mobile the middle ear system is. So if it's not as mobile as we would expect, we can then look at referring on to ENT to get that sorted.
Yep. Might come back to some of that equipment you use. How long can you wait before? This is just a big area that I see, so I'm really curious to know how long can you wait before you should probably get a hearing test? Is it 3 months usually with the fluid sitting there, you know, or is it really case by case, you know, depending on how it's affecting them? And
Definitely case by case. I think earlier is always better than later.
Yep.
With children, they develop so much in such a short period of time that I'm a big fan of have a look at it as soon as we can.
Mm.
If we see something for the first time, generally we'll say, let's see you in 6 to 8 weeks and see if it spontaneously resolves. If it doesn't, then definitely onto ENT.
Mm.
But if you were to refer in someone and they're not talking and there's great parental concern and you suspect it's been going on for quite some time, often after that first time I'm happy to refer on to get that sorted so that they can move forward with medical management.
Yep, okay. What are some of the other causes of hearing loss in children?
Okay, that's a fabulous question, Andrew. So we like to talk about hearing loss as being either congenital or acquired. So the most common causes of congenital hearing loss are your genetic hearing losses. So hearing loss does run in families. We also have intrauterine infections that can show up later on, like the cytomegalovirus or CMV, which people don't often know they've got, because it manifests like a mild cold, and it's not until the child is born that we'll pick up on those kinds of things. And then you've got your syndromic losses. So children with Down syndrome will often be, you know, have middle ear problems just due to the anatomy being a lot smaller. The ear canal is tiny. Mm. The Eustachian tube doesn't work so well. And then you've got your tretrocolons and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Cormaxo.
Yep. Some. Yeah, so some big terms.
There are big terms in there, yes.
With the newborn screening, do you get involved in that? Or?
So when we don't do the newborn screening itself, but we run an early intervention program. So children are picked up by the newborn screening program and they're referred to both PCH and Hearing Australia. Hearing Australia will then fit them with devices, and as part of that process they often get referred on to us for early intervention so we can help the families with the management of the devices, getting used to them, understanding what they do and how to establish full-time use and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Can be quite daunting for parents, I'm sure.
Certainly can.
Is that newborn test very accurate?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
I get asked that a lot.
Yeah.
Because they want to check, is this child listening or not?
So whilst it's very accurate, it's really important to remember that it's just a snapshot in time. So it means that when your child is born, that their hearing is either normal or it's been passed on to, for further investigation. It doesn't mean to say that down the track they're not going to acquire a virus or have some sort of illness or injury, or even some medications that might be life-saving can affect your hearing. So it's really good to make sure that if you're worried that you check them down the track. It's a great starting point, but it's not, it doesn't mean they're okay forever.
Yeah. and then there's also a second step, usually in school, certainly in Western Australia, I think about kindy time, they do a check. I don't know about other states, but that's sort of a second screening that's done, and also really important as a check-in. So is that another snapshot, what you'd call another snapshot?
Yeah, that is another snapshot. So they tend to be a fairly simple test, and they generally will have a quick look at the middle ear health using that screening tool of tympanometry and sometimes a quick hearing check. That's a time where we do often pick up a lot of those children who've been missed in their early childhood with their middle ear problems. And it's that at that point it's good to refer straight on to audiology if there's a problem
there. Yeah. So audiology, so they end up with being referred to you. What would be your usual sort of investigation at an audiology centre?
Yep. So we would normally have a chat with the parents. So we send out a survey before they come in with that asks for a range of questions so we can pick up on any risk factors and observations that parents have noted. Because we're working with a young cohort, myself, I usually get in and do the testing first and talk more later. So we go straight in the younger children. So that's our 6 month to 3 years of age cohort. We do what we call conditioned response audiometry. So we basically teach them that when they hear something, they get to see a visual reward of some sort, like a screen or a puppet. So we can test babies quite young, and it's generally quite a fun process for most children.
So do they respond quite quickly to that, do they? That sort of training and stimuli.
For sure, yeah. So we find the best responses between 9 and 18 months when they're in that happy to sit at a, in a high chair or at a little table. When they start getting a bit older, sometimes they can be a bit suspicious of people they don't know or become a bit engrossed in the gentle distraction task that we give them.
Yes.
So it can be trickier, but we're very experienced to deal with that over there. Once they are over three or developmentally ready, some children are ready earlier, obviously, we do what we call play audiometry, where we teach them that when they hear a sound, they perform a task, whether that be drop a block in a bucket or a marble in a race. I'll play peekaboo, catch the sound. There's a million ways we can play it, but basically they do a task when they hear a sound and we make it a game so that it's quite a fun process. So in the younger children, we do what we call screening in the free field. So we're checking their overall level of hearing. Because most of them won't wear headphones. And what we're looking for is can they access all the sounds they need for speech and language development.
Yep, that's great. And for the non-compliant children, we just try again another time, basically. Or you get some idea by doing a look and
generally
assessing them.
Because we send the pre-questionnaire, we have a bit of an idea. So if we've got what we would consider a more difficult than normal to test child, we would book two audiologists.
Yep.
So we have a distractor in the room with them as well as an audiologist, and we use a talkover system so we can communicate with each other. And so we have a rather large bag of tricks in our cohort for trying to get results from those kinds of children. So we can do the games a million different ways now, and generally speaking can test most children. If we can't test them, then we would refer on for what we call an ABR under sedation, which is a repeat of the test they have when they're born, but they need to be sedated because most children in that age bracket won't just lie down.
But you try to avoid to get to that.
We would try to avoid that for sure. Yeah. So we would usually see them at least two or three times before referring for that kind of thing.
Yep. You mentioned tympanogram.
Tympanogram?
Tympanogram.
Yes, it's a big
tongue twister. I know that's sometimes even used by specialists as well, some GPs. What is that exactly? What does that do?
So basically it's a pressure test. So we seal off the ear canal with a little probe and then we just force a tiny change in pressure and have a look at how mobile the eardrum is. Mm. So if the eardrum is moving normally, we see a nice movement when we change the pressure. If we try and change the pressure and there's no change, that indicates that there's some fluid in behind that's stopping the eardrum moving like it should.
Yeah. So it's a pretty good indicator
then. Yeah, it's a nice, quick, simple tool.
It is, yeah, yeah. A little step back, like how do parents get to an audiologist? Can they just ring up Telethon and say we'd like to have a screening test or should they be referred?
Certainly, you can self-refer. So you can hop onto our website and have a look for the phone number or give the girls a call.
Okay. What I find is I refer and then I've got that feedback loop and I can sort of see the progress over time, and you often do a two or three readings and we can track the fluid behind the eardrum. Is there a cost involved with seeing an audiologist, or does Medicare cover that?
So our service at TSH is a private service, so you do pay to see the audiologist. You can see your GP about a care management plan, which is for chronic management, and they can include a Medicare rebate.
Yeah.
Some of that.
Yeah. So I guess if the condition's considered chronic, like chronic hearing loss, chronic recurrent ear infections, that's where the care plan may be useful to involve the audiologist, potentially an ENT as well.
If people self-refer, I always love to ask them who their GP is and write back to you so you know what we've done.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So with these sorts of causes in mind, what are some of the treatment options? What would you normally see with, say, fluid behind the ear? If it's become persistent, what would you normally do for treatment?
So for that sort of thing, we refer back to the GP and recommend referral to an ear, nose and throat specialist. So for chronic glue ear, which is when there's no active infection, just a build-up of fluid that's affecting hearing, the usual treatment for that would be surgery for grommets. Mm. So that's a quick procedure, surgically speaking, that involves popping some little ventilation tubes in to allow the fluid out through the eardrum and the air in so that the system can work as normal.
Yeah, I found with grommets that can be very rewarding as well. So parents don't need to get too scared if this is what is happening. Can be very rewarding because they suddenly, if the child can hear again, instead of being surrounded by fluid in that essential part of the hearing process, it's ventilated, it's open, it can breathe again and the sound waves can get in. And I think the difference then the child is usually a bit happier. I wonder whether fluid causes pain, but they just seem happier in themselves and also their speech tends to flourish. That's my experience with grommets when it's done right.
Correct, yeah. Yep. A lot of people describe glue ear as having that feeling of being underwater. So it's quite exhausting when you're trying to listen in that sort of situation. So you'll find that kids with glue ear will often present with behavioural problems as well because they become tired very quickly. So when they're in a daycare environment or, pre-kindy, if they're struggling to listen all day by the time they get home, they might be having post-school meltdowns just from that listening fatigue.
Yeah. And I've seen another correlation of children who've had quite bad ear infections who aren't sleeping for multiple nights. And I never thought of that. We never taught that. But now it makes sense, if I've got a child that's suddenly not sleeping, to check their ears, because it can sometimes be that it's trapped. There's a pressure there. When they lie down with gravity, pressure gets worse. I don't know what your experience with that is.
Yeah, so when children have got acute otitis media, when they've got an active infection in there and their eardrum is physically bulging, that's very painful. So it certainly can affect their sleep as well as their hearing.
Yeah. what about management options of other causes of hearing loss? So what else do you do at Telethon that might be helpful to parents?
Sure. Yeah. So the other causes of hearing loss that might cause a permanent or what we call sensory neural hearing loss will require amplification of some sort, whether that be hearing aids, a streaming device, or a cochlear implant, depending on the level of the hearing loss.
Yep. So do you put them in or?
So we don't do that at Telethon. At the moment, Hearing Australia is the provider for children under 26.
Yep.
So all children diagnosed with a hearing loss are referred through to Hearing Australia for yep. amplification. If they are referred there and a hearing aid is deemed to be not enough, they are referred on to CHIP, which is the cochlear implant program, for a cochlear implant assessment.
Is that an expensive process for parents?
So all of that is covered publicly at the moment for children up to 26.
Okay.
So at Telethon, we are involved in the early intervention side of it. So we have our Chatterbox program for children who
tell me about that.
0 to 5.
Yeah.
And that's my area of and my passion is helping families through that period of early intervention. So the sooner we get hearing aids on and wearing them all waking hours, the earlier that speech and language can develop and the more likely it is that the child can continue on through their childhood as normal with their hearing devices.
So you also offer support with speech therapy, and how important is speech therapy for children at young ages?
That's a great question. We have a range of professionals involved in our Chatterbox program. We've got speech therapy. We've also got occupational therapy because there's a lot of children who have hearing loss and balance issues and also sometimes other things affecting their development. So we have a wonderful team of people and a beautiful gym as well.
Yep.
So all the children, they come in, and the program is led by an early a teacher. And it helps teach the parents what they need to do with their children. So we do sort of mat time where we do rhymes and read story reading and those sorts of things, some directed play and a lot of parent education.
Oh, it's really good. It does take a bit of an MDT approach, doesn't it, helping children through this and helping families through this. And as we said, it can affect a lot of developmental areas of a child's life. So we need to approach each of those and try and support the confidence of the child and help them to be able to speak again more clearly and understand words more clearly and catch up to the other kids. I'm just a bit on speech therapy because this often gets asked as well. If a child's not speaking, say 18 months, 2 years of age, like how early should we be getting speech therapy involved if, you know, we've sort of even got a bit of fluid in the ear or we don't? What is there a guideline around that, or is it case by case?
Generally speaking, if you're starting to see concerns in that 12 to 18 month period, it's certainly better to get onto it sooner rather than later. As the early in the intervention says, the earlier we get the interventions going, the better. It might be that you refer them in and the speech therapist has a look at them and says, you know what, everything's going okay, keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's really good to have that snapshot in time, because then if there still is a delay a little bit later on, they can say, well, this is where they are, and in 6 months they haven't made 6 months progress. Maybe we need to put some things in place.
Okay. That's good to know. And they're a really good resource as well. So you said that Chatterbox finishes at 5. What happens after that?
So we have our Outpost program, which supports hearing impaired children in schools, in private schools. Mm-hmm. So it gives parents the choice to send their child to schools other than the ones, the state schools that have a state-funded teacher of the deaf. We have teachers of the deaf audiology support that goes in and checks and helps to support the children in the school environment, educate the teachers, and also help the children advocate for themselves, because the sooner they learn that self-advocacy, the better they are as they go through life.
Sounds really great. It sounds like that you're sort of across the board involved in the different steps of the child's life in terms of if hearing is becoming an issue. And I'm sure there are services like this over in different states of Australia. We don't know them all, but they are there, and people just need to find out how to access them. So do you have any resources that you would tell people to go to online to look up more information about concerns with hearing loss, or looking into treatments that are available, that kind of thing?
That's a fabulous question, Andrew, because as you know, there's so much out there. The two that I would probably direct people to are the Hearing Australia website. It has a fabulous resource on there, and also Aussie Deaf Kids. They've got some great information. Our website has some good information on how to access our services as well.
Yep, so I'll put all those links up in the notes of this podcast episode. But thank you very much for giving up your time today. I know it's a busy schedule that you have. Really appreciate it, and so do the families that are listening to this. It's always helpful to hear from a professional in an area like this, a really important area. So thanks, Naomi.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the Kids Health Network. Be sure to keep an eye on our Facebook page for updates.